Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening and welcome to the Charlotte Line. This is Dr. John, and it's a cold and clammy, rainy night in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, but I know it's warm inside where we all are, and we're all looking forward tonight to do a rewind for the Napa Auto Parts 500 from 2002. That was a long time ago. So anyway, how are our people? Brady, how you doing tonight?
Oh, can't complain. Been pretty busy up here in Iowa, getting everything adjusted to pretty much almost everything having to shut down due to COVID. But now adjusting pretty okay. Got the apartment all kind of rearranged, so it's a little more conducive to the work from home office stuff, and I had to make for ourselves. So doing all right.
Well, let me ask you something: are the streets kind of vacant up there?
Pretty vacant, more so than a normal Saturday night in Iowa.
Well, there isn't much popping off in Iowa on Saturday night anyway, so.
Well, I
know. Depends on where you look.
Yeah. No, Iowa City's pretty cool. I love Iowa City. It's a great town. But anyway, we're glad you're here and hopping and bobbing and ready to roll. And Zach, how are you doing tonight?
I am tired, but I'm excited because even though, like you said, we don't have any real racing action, we technically had a race this weekend. It was the iRacing Pro Invitational, which actually I am currently rewatching. Brady watched it live, so and we're also going to talk about, like you said, the Auto Club 500 from 2012. The significance about that race: Jimmy Johnson's first win ever in his 13th start. So I'm excited about racing action, even if it's not real or if it's almost 12 years old? Yeah, wow.
12 years old? Well, I think this one's about 18 years old, isn't it? 2008.
Yeah,
about
18.
Yeah. And it's kind of like you're sitting down getting ready to watch golf on a Saturday afternoon on television, and it rains, and they end up having to show highlights from the 1983 Buick Open or some such nonsense, and you still love it. Because they show something old enough that nobody remembers who won, so it's great. So it's always
except for the guy who did win.
Yeah, exactly. Hopefully he's there, and we'll remember. I mean, if it's 1983, 93, 2000. Golly, that's like 37 years ago. He might not still be around. But anyway, it's good to have everybody here. So where are we headed tonight? I'm going to pick on Zach to get us started.
Well, I think what we should do, since we actually had quote-unquote racing action this weekend, is talk about the interesting race that NASCAR put together called the iRacing Pro Invitational. It is the first of its kind. It was televised on Fox Sports 1, and actually there will be another race this weekend. We will talk about that before we go off the air, which is again, going to be the Pro Invitational. But it had a wide variety of drivers. It had current Cup Series drivers. It had a couple former Cup Series drivers. It had truck and Xfinity drivers also in it. It was an interesting thing for NASCAR to put on. Even though we can't be at the track for the next few weeks, it's still an interesting thing to have that, I guess, that dynamic, that feeling that there's an actual race going on, that we are actually getting this very cool 3D simulator race going on, and I love it because the fact that we actually got some commentary from the actual commentators, NASCAR's own Jeff Gordon and Mike Joy were commentating on the race as if it was a normal race, which was really interesting.
And the neat thing about it, you know, it might be kind of controversial to say, but I honestly think that was the most solid broadcast that those two have put together so far this year without Darrell Waltrip up in the booth, because they were, I don't know, they just seemed very relaxed. They seemed very confident. They played off each other beautifully, and there was a lot to talk about. The race was definitely interesting. The thing that really stood out to me that I enjoyed a lot, and Steph even said it really made it seem like a legit deal, a legit kind of race, was the fact that before the race, you know, they had the pre-race invocation. They did the national anthem. They inserted crowd noises, and they turned that crowd noise up when Dale Jr. took the lead. Just the little minute things that they did to pay attention to the details to kind of make it still feel like an actual NASCAR event that we were getting prepped for. All the pre-race pageantries were there. It felt real, even though it was all simulated. And it was so cool because a lot of the drivers, they had either their wives, their girlfriends, or a PR rep, you know, live streaming them either through Instagram Live, Facebook Live, on their social media accounts. So that way fans could tune in and actually see in the driver's homes, watching them in the simulation. And a lot of them had fun with it. Alex Bowman had some fun, you know, tweeting about his dog, kind of getting in and accidentally wrecking half the field. Bubba Wallace's girlfriend was giving him, you know, crap the entire time, throwing goldfish at him. Ty Dillon, you know, taking it a step further and how he's giving his wife, Haley Dillon, daily lessons in the simulator, working on her skills to become a sim racer. So just little things like that. And then Michael Waltrip even did a grid walk. He showed up to Denny Hamlin's house and basically did the grid walk and did a funny throwback call to when he accidentally dropped a taco on Denny Hamlin's car back window. So he's like, "Hey, Denny, can I offer you a taco?" So it was cool. It was very laid back. The drivers definitely seemed like they were enjoying their time. And if you saw the Twitter video going around, Dale Earnhardt Jr. was so in his element and so relaxed that he one-hand drove his car the entire race. He might as well have had a Budweiser in the other hand, as relaxed as he was, which made it even funnier because when they came down for the finish, it was a very close side-by-side finish that came down to a margin of victory of only, let me pull it up here real quick, 0.153 seconds between Denny Hamlin and Dale Earnhardt Jr. And the way that Denny Hamlin was kind of loose and really, you know, side drafting Jr. a lot in those last few corners, I could just picture in my head Denny Hamlin, you know, elbows up, just going super aggressive, you know, giving it all he has. And then when you look at Dale Jr., just kind of one arm in the whole thing, it was kind of funny to me. But now, Zach, what was your take on the whole thing? Because it really was something special, and I'm glad we're going to see more of it, it sounds like.
So for me, it's something that, as someone that's an avid video gamer, I know people are going to say, iRacing is a video game, and then you're going to have people saying, iRacing is not a video game, it's a simulation. As someone that loves racing games in general, and has actually been on iRacing, wasn't my account, luckily, so I didn't lose any points in the licensing bracket that they do. It was really interesting because we still got the racing. We still got that, you know, that joy of community, even if you didn't have your buddy at your house watching it, or if you weren't at the bar watching it, you could still call them up and be like, "Man, did you see what's going on?" What's really interesting to me that I love about this is that it's an even playing field across the board. The cars are all identical. The only difference is manufacturer. And we also got drivers that aren't Cup Series drivers, and even retired Cup Series drivers. Not only was Dale Earnhardt Jr. in there, but the other notable one was Bobby Labonte, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah,
you are correct. Bobby Labonte drove the 19.
Which is interesting. And then you had drivers who aren't Cup Series regulars or in the best equipment sometimes. For instance, Ross Chastain, who was in the sixth car for Ross Fenway. Very interesting to see him in that. Then you had Anthony Alfredo, who's an Xfinity driver, racing in the 33. You had Ryan Truex in the 40, who is a Truck Series driver. Ty Majeski, who is an iRacing legend. If you don't know who Ty Majeski is, but you know iRacing, something is really wrong with you, because he is a driver that has won over 1,000 races. In fact, that's how he got started in NASCAR. And he made his debut in NASCAR with an iRacing scheme at the Iowa Speedway. Fun fact, me and Brady were at that race. But you also had like Garrett Smithley, Timmy Hill, and Parker Klingemann, who don't have the best equipment, but they were up there. Smithley got the pole. Timmy Hill was third and led a bunch of laps. Landon Castle was in there. Drivers that didn't make the field, who aren't, you know, in the Cup Series. Justin Haley, who, yes, he's made a handful of Xfinity starts. Jesse Gray, who did not make it in the 36. Jeffrey Earnhardt in the 50, who didn't make it. Stuart Friesen in the 52. And Matt Snyder in the 93. All didn't make it, but still attempted to, which is interesting to me. They had qualifying. Yes, it wasn't televised, but they still had qualifying. I love it because of the fact that we get the dynamic of having an actual race. Yes, it doesn't count towards points, but it's interesting that we are having a race. We're having a lot of fun with it, you know, drivers posting stuff on Twitter, and even seeing the rigs that people have set up. You know, you see Denny Hamlin, Kyle Busch, Jimmy Johnson, they have full-blown rigs with, actuators moving the car, and then you have Timmy Hill, who legitimately has a monitor probably as old, you know, probably 10 years old, just a square monitor, and he finished third. So here, equipment doesn't mean crap. What does mean, or what it does show, is if you have skills to drive. And I loved it. I'm still watching, I'm rewatching through it because it was just a fun race. And some of the paint schemes on there, too, were really cool and interesting, like Chase Elliott. He actually ran the black and orange 9 Hooters car that he was supposed to run that in the truck series at Atlanta a couple weekends ago.
And it was just a really cool just showcase of a bunch of different sponsors. Dale Jr. was able to tie in his own company, Filter Time, that he co-owns with Blake Cook. Ty Majeski was able to bring in CMR Construction, which has had great ties in both the Xfinity Series and truck series with various schemes, most notably with Ryan Sieg Racing. And it was just good racing. It was, like you mentioned, it was cool to see the different driver sim rig setups. The most really low budget one of the group has to be Ty Majeski, which you really have to give it to him, because it's an amazing miracle that he's as decorated and as talented and as accomplished as much as he has on iRacing, because he literally races on a laptop. I'm not even kidding you. He has a laptop with a little tiny desk fan blowing at a bowl of ice right near the heat vent to keep the unit from over-frying itself. It's super, super shoestring budget-looking material, but he gets the most out of it and is one of the best at the iRacing simulations. And just a little bit of race statistics, we saw 9 caution flags for 42 laps. The race was only 100 laps, so that'll kind of tell you kind of the adjustment that these drivers were in for. A lot of these drivers never had done any sim racing, so there was definitely a lot for them to adapt to and get used to. There was 11 lead changes amongst 6 different drivers. Your leaders included William Byron, who led out front for 28 laps and looked to be the early race favorite, but he ended up fading late in the event to finish outside in the 34th position, so not at all what the afternoon he was looking for. Garrett Smithley led 24 laps, as Zach said, had a fantastic afternoon in that 51. Denny Hamlin, your winner, led 14 laps. Dale Earnhardt Jr. also out front for 14 laps. Timmy Hill, a fantastic afternoon. He led out front for 13. And Chase Briscoe led the remaining 7 laps. Full race rundown for as far as the finishing order. Denny Hamlin did win the event. Dale Earnhardt Jr. came across the line in 2nd. Timmy Hill came across the line in 3rd. Chase Briscoe in 4th. Garrett Smithley rounds out your top 5. In 6th, we have Alex Bowman, followed by Bubba Wallace in 7th. Ryan Preece in 8th. Ty Majeski came home in 9th, and Eric Jones rounded out the top 10. A little bit further down your leaderboard, we have Matt DiBenedetto coming across the line in 11th. Landon Castle, a fantastic outing for the number 89 Chevrolet. He came across the line in 12th. Parker Kligerman coming across the line in 13th. Ross Chastain in 14th. And Joey Logano finishes out the top 15. Clint Bowyer, who had an interesting role in Sunday's race, he was the in-race reporter, which it's kind of become a time-honored tradition of any NASCAR broadcast, and it was just even more visceral and cool to be right there in the living room with Clint. You know, he had no mic issues. You could hear him clear as day, and he was just having a ball just in his element, racing and talking at the same time. So fantastic outing for Clint Bowyer, really entertaining for him.
Yeah, we'll talk about that once you finish out that round the finishing order, because there's some funny stuff with that we have to talk about.
Oh yeah, definitely. We'll have to go a little more in depth with that, because I feel like that's a future calling for Mr. Bowyer. But he could prop up number 14 for at home in 16th place. Ryan Truex in the number 40 came home in 17th. Bobby Labonte coming out of retirement, he logged a bunch of hours in the sim rig last week. We'll have to talk about that as well. But he came home in the 18th position, kind of fittingly. Ty Dillon came across the line in 19th. Justin Allgaier rounded out the top 20. Ricky Stenhouse Jr. brought home his number 47 in 21st place. Austin Cindric came home in 22nd. Michael McDowell came home in the 23rd position. Chase Elliott, 24th. And Brad Keselowski came home 25th. In 26th position, we had Christopher Bell, 27th, Austin Dillon. 28th was Chris Buescher, 29th, Kyle Busch, who had a very horrendous afternoon in his number 18. John Hunter Nemechek came home in 30th. Jimmy Johnson, 31st. Anthony Alfredo, 32nd. Kyle Larson, 33rd. William Byron, 34th. And Kurt Busch finished 35th.
So, real quick on that finishing order, some people may say, well, it's a simulator. How come some guys, because on there, I don't know if it tells you, but some guys didn't finish the race at all. there was a handful of people who didn't finish the race. So one thing in iRacing is your car can get a reset. It can be restored back to the way back to a brand new car essentially. It just takes time on your pit stop and stuff, but you only get a certain number. In most races that are sanctioned, you get one, but because of this, of it being a entertaining, you know, fun race, no points, no nothing, they did two. And it's been interesting to hear people say, like, oh, they got a reset button, you know, reset button, reset button. It is funny, and it makes me think of a clip of Travis Pastrana talking about driving a monster truck. The guy makes reference, yeah, it's kind of like driving a video game. And then he just starts yelling out, reset button, reset button. One thing that you had mentioned, Clint Bowyer was the driver, what was it again? The driver.
The in-race reporter.
Thank you, in-race reporter. So the interesting thing was, he was actually at the Fox Food Studios. He had brought his all of his equipment from home to the studio. He was probably less than 20 feet, and Mike Joy even said he was down the hall from him and Gordon. It was interesting to see that and have him and be able to understand him the entire time instead of him being muffled and be like, hey, you know, and you hear the engine. Instead, it was just Clint being Clint Bowyer. It was so interesting and fun to watch, you know, what Clint not just had to say, but like his reaction to a lot of that stuff and the way he was able to run the race, and ran pretty well for the most part, even dogging people like Jimmy Johnson saying, oh, Jimmy had to go to the bathroom. Oh, he's getting old. I'm like, oh boy, that's Clint Bowyer. And I think you are right when you said that earlier, that I think we found his future calling of being a broadcaster in the booth. Maybe next couple years or so. If not, he will be in the booth sometimes for the Xfinity races. I think my favorite thing about this was just the wide variety of drivers in the top five. Do you still have the finishing order in front of you?
I do, yes.
So you had Denny Hamlin, Daytona 500 champion three times now, two times in a row. You had Dale Earnhardt Jr., a.k.a., you know, Earnhardt, two-time Daytona 500 champion. And then Timmy Hill. Timmy Hill. And by the way, Timmy Hill was up there the entire race. He was up front. I'd say probably 90% of the time he was up there in the top five, if not the top 10, and he finished third. I think that just shows what kind of talent a driver does have when everything is equal. It's kind of like the IROC series, if people remember that. You know, the cars are all similar, as close as they can be. And it just shows off talent. And I love that about this because it's kind of like racing the super speedway. You can have the quote unquote smaller teams, AKA Timmy Hill, finish third, but there's no damage to the cars, there's no extra costs to the cars being damaged or anything. But it was a fun race. And I'm still watching some of the highlights and just seeing, you know, the cars go by and the camera work and everything. That's the thing I think people now can understand and really like about this is the fact that we can get all these different views no matter what the angle is. You can get in-car cameras from every single car. You can get, you know, an aerial view, and you can get any and all types of views, which is very interesting, and I love it watching this race because it's cool to see them actually. It feels like you're actually watching a race at the track somewhere. Yes, you can tell it's not real life and stuff, but just the way the cameras move, the pan shots, everything, it's so cool to see that, and I love it so much.
And it was a huge success. They're already starting to pull in some of the viewer numbers and some of the Nielsen ratings. According to Nielsen, 903,000 viewers tuned into FS1 for the first ever telecast of the eSports Invitational Race. And according to them, it is the highest, most watched telecast on Fox Sports 1 since the COVID pandemic swept the nation about a couple weeks ago. It was also the highest rated eSports television program in history. So a huge mark, not just for NASCAR, but for any eSports sanctioned league, for legitimacy, for, you know, showing people that, hey, people will tune into this, virtual or not. People will still tune in to see competition. And the nice, you know, rippling effect of this being a success is Fox Sports announced today that they are committed to televising the remainder of the eSports Pro Invitational League for however long that we are in shutdown, however long that it takes for us to get back to the racetrack. NASCAR, Fox Sports, and these drivers, they're going to continue going to the virtual counterparts of the track that we're supposed to be at this weekend, which this upcoming weekend we're supposed to be at Texas Motor Speedway. So the Pro Invitational event will be at the virtual Texas Raceway. And we're going to just do racing now until we can go back to the actual track. And that's so fantastic because I don't know about you, but a lot of fans out there, we're looking for something to do. We want racing to satisfy our time, and we have the technology now. We have the drivers who are willing to commit to put on the show for us. And it's just such a great way, to, you know, with the social media engagement, with the fans, like I said, being able to live stream a driver's, you know, in-car action, live stream right from where he's running in the simulation. We're starting to get see more drivers get interested in getting their own sim rigs, you know, getting their car set up so they can maybe throw their hat in the ring. So it could really, you know, spur it on and become something in and of itself and really take on a whole life. So I'm anxious to see how that, you know, progresses forward and what it means for the future of eNASCAR. But I'm just excited that it means that until we can see cars roaring around the tracks for real again, we are at least committed to having, in a virtual sense, racing for the next who knows how long, umpteen weeks, while we're waiting out this pandemic. So just big tip of the hat to NASCAR for taking a risk on this, for Fox Sports 1, for broadcasting it, and all the drivers who, you know, pulled together, made it fun, you know, just made it enjoyable, and just gave us something to cheer about and gave us something to watch again while we're trying to make the most of a bad situation.
And I do love that, you know, we got ratings from it. And someone had actually mentioned, they're like, oh, well, it's not like what they normally get. And I had to point out, you know, A, they didn't have it on, you know, national television. They had it technically on cable on Fox Sports 1. It wasn't on the regular Fox channel. And two, the fact that they got almost 1 million viewers, you know, for it is incredible. And like you said, they're now committed to broadcasting the rest until we can go back to normal. The cool thing is that now it will be on regular Fox. It will be on Fox, like on the regular race day on Sunday. It will be on Fox, Fox Sports 1 and the Fox Sports app. So you, if, let's say you don't have one, let's say you have one of those, but not all of those, you can still watch the race somehow. And even if not, you can watch it on YouTube later. That's actually what I had to do because I couldn't find a legitimate source to watch it. Because all the bars are closed down, all the restaurants are closed, I couldn't go out and watch it. But it's so cool to see not just, you know, Fox taking the steps like, hey, we're committed, but also NASCAR, like you said, because this is huge. You know, there's a lot of not just, you know, drivers, but a lot of NASCAR workers. You know, I got a lot of friends that work in NASCAR that they're not out of work, but they're not working as much as they would be. You know, one driver, one person in particular, Timmy Hill, even though he finished, you know, even though he is a driver in the Cup and the Xfinity Series, he owns his own team. He owns his own Truck Series team that, you know, he said after he was done with the race, he didn't just, like, chill at home and drink a beer. No, he went to the shop. He was building his next truck or getting the truck ready for whatever race. And it's interesting because I love that NASCAR can be like this where we have, you know, all these drivers here, not well, here on the race, but here doing this for the fans. You know, a lot of these drivers were at home. Actually, a few drivers weren't at home. They were at, like, Michael McDowell was actually at DG Crossley because they have a sim set up there. Clint Bowyer, of course, was at his the Fox Studios in Charlotte. It's cool to see. I love it, and I can't wait to. I want to go through all the drivers' like social media and see like, okay, like you said, Junior did the whole race one-handed, which is nuts because Homestead is an interesting track to try to run one-handed in real life. You also had, you know, like you said, there's just so much to this that can add not just entertainment value but show that these drivers are human essentially.
Also, you know, going further than the Nielsen ratings, this was also a huge boost for NASCAR in terms of social media engagement and, you know, hitting at that target age range that they're always trying to get at, that demographic that always seems so elusive, the 18 to 35-year-old bracket. And according to not just Nielsen, but we also got some data from Twitter interactions from their official data mining and seeing how things are ranked. The eNASCAR iRacing Pro Invitational Series on FS1 was the number one most social TV program overall on Sunday afternoon. NASCAR-owned content related to the event also produced over 1 million engagements throughout the weekend on Twitter. So that was a huge win for the industry, because that is where that key demographic is. That's where you're going to find the 18 to 35-year-olds, the Gen Zers, the millennials. You're going to find them online on Instagram, on Twitter. And so not only was this a huge win for NASCAR, you know, being able to help their current fans, you know, find a way to kill the time and get by while we're waiting to get back to actual racing, but this is going to be so pivotal in getting our drivers, getting our stars in front of a whole new audience that maybe never has tuned into a NASCAR race, or maybe thinks NASCAR is not for me. It's so old. The fan base is old. The technology is old. It's not for me. I don't want it. But this is showing that NASCAR is not, you know, the antiquated sport that many people have it in their mind. It's, you know, got a bunch of budding, you know, super high tech technology. The drivers are really engaged on social media, because I really can't think of another sport where you can just go up to the main, you know, the main guy on your team, the main quarterback essentially, and just engage with them, you know, do Facebook Live events with them, just go up to random, you know, autograph events all over the world. So it's just another big win for NASCAR if they're trying to step out their reach and really bring in a whole new audience and really, you know, secure the future for the sport going forward. And I think having this esports league, taking a chance on, you know, capitalizing on the fact that there is a big growing fan base, people who are tuning into the esports world, tuning into the e-gaming world more so than traditional sports, and recognizing that and being proactive about trying to capitalize on that rather than being reactive, saying, well, man, we should have really done something about that a couple of years ago, as the train completely passes them by. So I hope it pays off in the long haul, but this can only be positive as NASCAR just continually looks to find ways to bring in the modern fan.
That is for sure, especially, like you said, as someone myself, because I grew up playing racing games, and I'm going to relate this to this, you know, as someone that loves, you know, playing these video games as well, because I know people are going to say, like I said earlier, iRacing is not a video game. As someone that grew up playing video games, mainly racing games, I love that we get to see, I guess, what it really takes to run a sim race like this, because some people think it's a bunch of morons crashing into each other. Okay, well, if you watch this race, it kind of is that. But it's not. There are actual, you know, leagues, and I'm not talking bad about any of the drivers that are racing. In fact, I thought it was really cool because you got to see drivers take extra risks or do stuff that they wouldn't normally do at the track, you know, really get on the power getting out of turn four or really dive bombing it in, especially at Homestead. But as someone that grew up watching or playing video games and is a NASCAR fan, you know, it was easy for me to be like, okay, I'm a little skeptical about this. I think it's cool. Let's see what happens. And now after watching it, seeing the feedback, seeing everything, I'm on board with it. And then there's the side of people who are pure esports guy, because they're out there. They're just like people who watch football but don't play it. You know, these esports guys are like, you know, like, oh, NASCAR's not that cool, blah, blah, blah. They don't get pros. I don't see any pros, any pro football player, any pro basketball, any pro whatever hockey is. I don't see them that often playing a video game of their own sport or playing a game with, you know, the fans. But this is so cool. And there's drivers still who are racing. Matt Benedetto today posted on Snapchat him doing some racing for fun. Him and Timmy Hill were in a lobby racing with people. He did a street stock race with just some random fans. Like, this is something so cool that, like you said, the interaction with this is amazing, and it's nuts to see what all, you know, is capable of this, especially, you know, the interaction with fans on this and being able to see, you know, what the drivers are up to. The one thing I want to see is more drivers, you know, do a broadcast on like Twitch or something. And if you don't know what Twitch is, it's a streaming platform for just about anything. It's mainly video games. I actually streamed this weekend. I was building a Lego car because I had nothing else to do on a Sunday. But it just shows like what we are, you know, it's just cool. And I want to see this weekend. So this is a call out to the drivers. Create a Twitch account and stream it on there, like just your point of view, because it would be very cool to see what the drivers are doing you know, a little bit before the race, during the race, and right after the race. Are they getting up and stretching? Are they going to celebrate like Denny Hamlin did and had his wife yell language across the room because he used some colorful language? But I love this, and I cannot wait for Texas, which is coming up this weekend. And I don't know if there's a entry list out already or not. Actually, let me try to see if I find that, because I don't know if it's they I haven't heard anything or seen anything saying it's going to be the same drivers for every race or not.
Yeah, I've not heard on that either. So if you can find anything on that, let us know. But while we're still on, you know, on the topic of kind of, you know, current news, before we get into our topic, you know, our discussion on the California race later on the broadcast, there is still some news stories coming in, you know, related to the sport. We're still trying to wade our way through the COVID pandemic. And so one of the biggest news that came out this last week since our last broadcast was the 2020 Summer Olympics has officially announced that they are postponing that historic event to no later than summer of 2021. They're going to kind of, you know, wait and see, kind of see how the countries all progress and see how, you know, the cures start coming in, and hopefully maybe a vaccine is available by that time. But they are announcing that they are going to postpone that event. But what does that mean for NASCAR? Well, NASCAR is looking to try and reschedule a lot of these events that we're missing to try and deliver on the promise that we're going to get all 36 events in for 2020. So, you know, that's going to pose a scheduling conflict. But originally on the 2020 schedule docket, they had two back-to-back weekends off specifically for the 2020 Summer Olympics, because that's during the portion of the season that NBC and NBC Sports covers the NASCAR telecast. And, you know, rather than making NBC choose between NASCAR and the Olympics, one of the most biggest sporting events in the world, NASCAR decided to take those 2 weeks off to allow NBC to focus solely on broadcasting the Olympics and give their drivers, you know, a couple weeks to kind of refresh, kick back and whatnot. But with this COVID epidemic and the forcing of a bunch of races to postpone, those 2 weekends could become prime dates for rescheduling a lot of these missed events. So we'll definitely keep our ears to the ground on that and keep a finger on the pulse of that, because that could be huge as far as what the summer months are going to look like as far as scheduling the events and getting the NASCAR 2020 season back underway.
That is an interesting point, because we are missing, you know, so many races now that we have for sure. By the way, I think this is a good point. Are we going to go to the Olympics? Can we? Should we? Okay. But that is an interesting thing. The other thing that they're exploring is doing doubleheaders at tracks that do multiple races. There's only a couple of them that don't do it during the chase, and I think one of them is Michigan. But it's going to be interesting to see, because one thing they're dabbling with also is doing midweek races, which would put a little strain on the team. But if that's what we have to do to get the whole 36 race season in, that might be what has to happen. It will be interesting, though. And one thing, I'm going to put it out there. I'm going to put the feeler out there. Feel me out. Hear me out on this. They move the All-Star race to the Thursday before the Coca-Cola 600.
I could be on board with that. I would definitely be supportive of that.
Because that would give the teams, a lot of teams, you know, that extra week, that weekend before, the opportunity to run a race somewhere, whether it be, you know, Texas or Homestead or something relatively close, so that way the teams can get back and straight to Charlotte and get their cars ready if they're going to run both the Xfinity or both the All-Star race and the 600 that weekend. One other notable thing that is coming out of the pipelines is, and this was kind of said last year, I'm just going to say this because it had been resurfaced again. There's a famous boxer who wanted to join NASCAR. He had something planned for Homestead of last year. It didn't pop up, or it didn't happen. But again, it's happened again. It's popped up. Floyd Mayweather is talking about possibly running a NASCAR team now.
Yeah, I've heard a little bits of that. Before we dive too much into the Floyd Mayweather story, one other interesting thing about scheduling before we kind of put the kibosh on that. I've heard maybe a possible doubleheader between NASCAR and IndyCar for the famous Indianapolis Motor Speedway races. This wouldn't be necessarily for the Indy 500, but supposedly IndyCar officials are looking at moving their Grand Prix race, where they run the Indy cars on the infield road course, to the weekend of July 4th, when NASCAR is expected to be running their two races, the Xfinity Series and the Brickyard 400. That would be coincidental because, and really favorable if they do move it to that weekend, because the Xfinity Series drivers are also going to be utilizing the Grand Prix infield road course. So that might be interesting, because we've seen a lot of people kind of clamor for a NASCAR Cup Series IndyCar doubleheader, because they think it'd be greatly beneficial for supporters of both series. Maybe get open wheel fans a little taste of the stock car action, and maybe bring in some fans from that, and vice versa. Maybe some stock car fans get to see open wheel racing for the first time and get them tuned into the season. So definitely have to keep our ears to the ground on that, because that could be hugely beneficial from a from an engagement standpoint for both of those two series. But getting back to the Floyd Mayweather story,
Hold on, real quick on that. I do want to clarify, there has been times where NASCAR has won with IndyCar. It is not the Cup Series, though. It's either been the Xfinity Series or the Truck Series running at the same track. A great example is Iowa. They had the Truck Series and the Xfinity Series run there before. They've done the same at Texas. So before people jump down and say, no, they have run, it's the Sub Series. It's never been the Cup guys running with them. So it would be interesting to see that.
Exactly. But getting back to the Floyd Mayweather deal, it's kind of a really interesting, kind of shady deal. Is it a will they, won't they? It's almost like Schrodinger's NASCAR team. Is it established or is it just a pipe dream? We really don't know at this point, because he's been teasing on social media. I heard that he was supposed to be entering a virtual car for one of the drivers for the Pro Invitational race, but I don't know if anything ever came of that. So I don't know, Zach. This one's been utterly perplexing me since they announced it towards the end of 2019.
Yeah, it's just something. It's popped up back on the Twitter sphere, in the Facebook sphere. There was speculation that technically Jeffrey Earnhardt was going to be sponsored by him in the iRacing League. Who knows at this point? So it's just something that I want to put the speculation and tell people, hey, it's out there. I'm giving you the information. Go. If anyone knows Floyd himself, have him call me. I'll talk to him. You know, me and him can get along. We can't read Harry Potter books that well.
Oh, my.
there's a callback to some of them. So, with that, I feel like we should talk about some retro racing. How about that, guys?
Well, let's go retro racing. It was a beautiful Sunday afternoon. No, I'm just kidding. No, it was a really entertaining race watching the old O2. Because O2 was the very last season before NASCAR kind of went IROC with the main division and kind of went to a more generic kind of styling templates and aero packages. Back when the manufacturers had a lot more, you know, input on the design of the car as far as the body, the look of the body. It was more individualized, more tailored. And, you know, it felt very much like the Gen 6 car that we have on the track now, you know, minus the fact that the Gen 6 cars are very, very much sealed off to the track and as low as they can possibly go. But as far as, you know, how they're all kind of aerodynamically, they're all the same. You could distinctly look at the distinctual character lines of each manufacturer and pick out, you know, a Chevy from a Toyota. And that's what it felt like watching this O2 race, where you could tell those were definitely not production Monte Carlos and Grand Prix and Tauruses, but they were similar enough to their production counterpart and different enough from one another that you could still tell them apart. And that was really refreshing to watch, and also made me feel really good, honestly, about the current car that we have, and even more excited about the direction that we're going with the NASCAR Next Gen car. But the racing was phenomenal. I really enjoyed this was, for a lot of you fans out there, this was the Generation 4 car, you know, before things became super aeroized and before things became super sealed off the track. There was still some ride height. There were some different aero tweaks as far as you could do to the fenders, and just a lot more creativity that the teams could have as far as adjustments and different tweaks that they could make to the body and overall styling of the car to make it react differently if you wanted to have more handling versus more overall top-end speed. And just the way that they were able to incorporate that into the broadcast, it was just very fascinating to watch from a historic perspective, but also compared to what we've been used to through four races in 2020 and from a lot of the most recent races we've had with the Gen 6 car.
Exactly. And it's really cool to look back at this because, like we said last week, it was Jimmy Johnson's first win. It was his 13th start ever. A really interesting fact about that, Kent, I hope you know this. There was one driver that made his debut that weekend. Who was it?
Made his debut that weekend. I'm trying to think. Mm-hmm. 02 would have been
you didn't catch
Greg
that?
Biffle?
Oh. Yes, you are correct. Greg Biffle made his first official start. He did try to qualify for the Daytona 500, but failed that week, or failed to, and instead made his debut for Jack Roush. It wasn't Jack. It wasn't Roush Fenway. It was just Roush Racing. Let's try it again. It was just Roush Racing at the time before Fenway and Roush combined. He started 29th and finished respectfully 13th, one lap down. But then again, the top 12 the top 11 were the only cars that were on the lead lap at the end of that race. But yeah, he made his first ever debut, led no laps, but still a respectable 13th finish for his debut for his first time ever there. It was a 43-car field with three cars not making it: Brendan Gaughan in the number 62, Chad Little in the 74, and Hermie Sadler in the 02. Those three did not make it. And it was a fun race. I actually watched it at work today, and I had a ball watching it because it's so cool to watch these races. Because when I was, let's see, that was 2002, 18 years ago, I was 8 years old when that race happened. And it's interesting to see everyone, you know, in all the drivers are in that. By the way, I counted Jimmy Johnson, Kurt Busch. Yeah, those are the only two drivers that are still racing today that was in that field. The only two.
It's just mind-boggling because those were our drivers. This was our childhood, Zach. And the fact that all of the stars that we grew up watching are now retired means we're officially old.
But I do love...
You're not old. Come on.
There we go. I was waiting for John to say
you are not old.
Old in my spirit.
It is interesting to look at this, you know, all the drivers that are on here, because it's not a hodgepodge, but it's quite a bit of different drivers. Everyone from, you know, Jimmy Johnson, Jeff Gordon, you know, Hendrick had three cars that weekend. Now he has four. You even had people like Michael Waltrip and Dale Earnhardt Jr., who were teammates, and Steve Park. Three cars, three Dale Earnhardt Incorporated cars racing that weekend. You had Petty Motorsports with three entries, I take that back, with Kyle Petty in the 45, John Andretti, God rest him, in the 43, and Steve Grissom in the 44. And then even like Joe Gibbs Racing, only two entries, and now they've grown to four. It's so weird to look at all these teams that were on here, all these owners that a lot of them are still in the in the race season, or are team owners still, and to go through them and be like, wow, that's just nuts. You know, even AJ Foyt, who does not run in the NASCAR series, he was even sponsoring the driver Stacy Compton, who actually led a lap for that race, but then had to retire because of an engine issue. It's so cool to look down this list and see so many, not just familiar names, but familiar sponsors. Some that are still in the sports today, like Napa, even though they're not on a DEI car or a Jeep Ganassi car, they're on a Chevy still. You have Roush Fenway Racing, who's still going at it. You have Sprint, who's no longer with it. But you have it's so cool to look at these. Even Hooters, as a whole, was on a car for Brett Bodine. Hooters Restaurants was on the 11 for that race.
And it's really interesting to kind of look at this from a historical standpoint. This was a very pivotal race in the 2002 season. It was right past the quarter mark in the season. And this was back when the championship was decided after all 36 races were run. There was no playoff. There was no chase of the championship. It was you had 36 races, and you had to have the best overall season, average finish-wise. You know, wins help, but weren't necessarily a requirement. And so for this being the quarter way mark, this was definitely separating the drivers that were going to be championship contenders versus drivers that, you know, would already start to look ahead towards 2003. And if you look at the point standings after this race, the eventual champion, Tony Stewart, was still Meyer 10th in points. He had a pretty hard start to the 2002 campaign with a 43rd place at Daytona and a 36th place in the fifth race of the season at Darlington. But sprinkled in amongst those races, he also had a 4th at California, 5th at Las Vegas, a win at Atlanta, and another 5th at Texas, and a 3rd at Martinsville, before a 29th at Talladega heading into the California race weekend, race number 10 of that season. But from there, that's where his championship season really took off. The very next weekend, he won the race at Richmond, and he just never looked back as he's, you know, climbs ever so steadily up the points. Other drivers faltered, ran into some issues throughout the summer where Stewart really shined, picking up another win at the Glen, to where he eventually capped off winning his first championship. So looking at this race, 10 races in of the 36, and seeing Tony Stewart mired in 10th, knowing that he would come back to win the championship, it was really cool to just kind of take that into a historical perspective. Also looking at this point standings field, Sterling Marlin was the leader in the points after this race and was looking like the championship favorite in the number 40 car. He would eventually have a crash that would take him out for a couple races to end the season, which would eventually lead to Jamie McMurray getting his big break and eventual first win. But looking at this, you know, knowing that in a few races, all this promise, all this hope and potential for the 2002 season for the Coors Light team would eventually come undone with that crash, it was kind of sobering to realize that, you know, there was so much success on the horizon for the 40 team, but a lot of heartbreak and a lot of setback that they really wouldn't recover from as a team overall. Kind of looking down a little further in the point standings, also kind of notable, kind of on the theme of crashes that were kind of, you know, not really seriously looked at the time, but would have major implications. Dale Earnhardt Jr., he came into California that weekend fresh off a win at Talladega and was also touted in the broadcast as accruing the most points over the last 6 races heading into the California race weekend than any other driver on the circuit. So for Dale Jr., coming off of a pretty solid 2001 campaign, he was definitely looking like championship aspirations at this point. He was thinking, okay, I've got the momentum. Our team is really gelling. This is my third season. This is my time. But coming down towards the latter stages of the race, lap 230, the final caution of the event, coming to try and go on to pit road, the number 29 of Kevin Harvick accidentally clipped the number 8 of Dale Jr., sending him head on into the turn 4 retaining wall. And this was back before the days of the advent of the safer barrier, so that was a hellacious hit. And the resulting injuries from that hit was actually a concussion that Dale Jr. kept hidden for the bulk of that summer and wouldn't actually reveal to the media and to NASCAR that he suffered those concussion symptoms until mid-September that year. But by that point, the damage was already done. The next week after the California crash, he followed that up with finishes of 36th at Richmond, 35th at Charlotte, and 30th at Dover, before he would rally to a 12th at Pocono, but then it was back to a 22nd at Michigan, 30th at Sonoma. So from those were the races that he was mostly feeling the effects of the concussions, and he was still out there, still racing, but you could definitely tell from those finishes, he was not racing at 100%. He was not fully there, and his season suffered from it. He toppled through the point standings throughout the summer months. He was able to eventually, you know, stop the bleeding once, you know, they got to Daytona. He got a solid 6th place finish from there. He was able to get some consistency throughout the fall and finished on a strong note, rallying to eventually finish 11th in the points. But what could have been for the number 8 team? Dale Jr. never did eventually win a championship. So you always have to look at that California crash, you know, during this very pivotal race for Jimmy Johnson. It was also a very pivotal race in the career of Dale Jr. when you think of all the injuries that he suffered throughout his career, the multiple concussions he's had, especially the 2012 and 2016 concussions that sidelined him from races and eventually ended his career short. You have to wonder, you know, what could have been different if he was able to avoid Harvick, or if maybe there were safer barriers installed at that track at that time, and maybe the impact wouldn't have been so severe. Maybe he wouldn't have had the concussion. You know, you can get into those spirals of all these what-ifs, but we'll never really know. But that's what's so fun about going back and reliving some of these vintage races, because you can look back with this kind of hindsight 2020 mirror and really appreciate some of the storylines that seemed kind of minor at the time that ended up being super important once you got further into the season.
That wreck, like you talked about, and it's one of only a handful of cautions we had, or that the race did have. It only had, five cautions. And that was the hardest one because there was one with the 49 car of Stacey Compton Shauna Robinson, I'm sorry, who backed it into the wall. Just a racing accident. She just got loose. And I know people are going to be like, that's kind of like Danica Patrick. No, it's nothing like Danica Patrick. Then you had Ricky Craven, who kind of had gotten up in the marbles. He got into the wall, nothing crazy. He kind of rode it out and was still able to finish the race. Matt Kenseth had an issue, and then the 19 stalled out. But then that wreck, that was the hardest wreck for both Junior and Harvick. You know, Harvick got the lighter note of it. But that head-on, like you said, with the wall, he hit at about roughly 134 miles per hour. Now, one thing I wanted to mention is that track, and we're going to hop into the future of a few seasons ago. Denny Hamlin actually had a very scary accident at Auto Club around the same area. It was more into turn four. He hit head-on into the inside barrier wall. He had a fractured vertebrae. If I'm not mistaken, he was out for quite a few races for the season. I want to say it was 2016?
13.
Oh, wow, I was off by that one. But that just shows how fast, especially if that track is. You know, they said they had time or speeds of over 207 miles per hour going into turn one. And for that time, you know, they had – this was a little over a year and 2 or 3 months, and Dale Sr. Had passed away at his Daytona crash. They had gotten rid of the open-face helmets. The Hans devices were not required. There was so much more that kind of helped him from having a much worse injury but still getting a concussion and suffering from that. Like you said, I do feel that would have been a year he possibly could have won a championship if he had – if some of the newer safety features, like the safety barrier there, that we could be talking about a different thing, how he had won the championship that year. It's just one
exactly.
of those what-if scenarios. But other notable drivers, and I want to go through this because there are just so many, I want to say legendary names because that's kind of what they are. By the way, I said the only two drivers that are active on this list was Jimmy Johnson and Kurt Busch. Technically, I was wrong. Ryan Newman is on there. Yes, he's still an active driver. He's just sidelined as of right now. But you had Jimmy Johnson, who won the race, Kurt Busch in the 97. By the way, going down this list, looking at all these different numbers, it's going to be weird because of how many drivers are in those cars or the cars are different now. It's just so weird. Ricky Rudd in the 28 finishing third. Phil Elliott in the 9 finishing fourth. Mark Martin finishing in the 5th spot in the number 6 car. Dale Jarrett in the 88 finishing 6th. Sterling Marlin, like you said, in the 40 car finishing 7th. Rusty Wallace in the number 2 finishing 8th. David Blaney, by the way, the father of Ryan Blaney, in the number 77 finishing 9th. Michael Waltrip finishing 10th in the number 15 car. Jeff Green in the number 30 finishing 11th. He's still an active racer in the Xfinity Series. He does some starts for Ryan Sieg Racing. You have Robbie Gordon in the 31, finishing 12th. Greg Biffle in the 16, again, making his debut. He's the only driver to make his debut on this list, finishing in the 13th. Ryan Newman in the 12 car, finishing 14th. Johnny Benson Jr., there is a name I have not heard in a very long time, in the number 10 car, finishing 15th. Jeff Gordon, he was some young gun back then. In the 24, finishing 16th. Kyle Petty in the 45, finishing 17th. Ward Burton, finishing in the 18th spot in the 22. That is Harrison Burton's father, right? Or is his uncle?
Jeff Burton is Harrison Burton's father. Ward Burton's the uncle. Jeff
He's
Burton
uncle. Okay,
is
well,
Ward Burton's son.
Well, funny enough, Jeff Burton finishes right behind him in the 19th and the number 99. Matt Kenseth in the 17th, started 20th, finishing 20th. Steve Park in the number 1, finishing 22nd. Brett Bodine in the number 11 Hooters, finishing 23rd. John Andretti in the famous 43, finishing 24th. Joe Niemicek, who floated in between teams that season, finishing in the 25th at the 26th car. Jerry Nadeau in the 25 car, finishing 26th. Jimmy Spencer, who Rowdy Spencer, in the 41, finishing 27th. Casey Atwood in the 28th, finishing 28th in the 7th car. Tony Stewart, I believe is his name, finishing 29th in the 20 car. Just had a late race incident. Wow, I can't speak tonight. Bobby Hamilton in the 55. There's a name you have not heard in a very long time, finishing 30th. Mike Skinner in the 4 car, finishing 31st. Rick Mass finishing the number 90 car, finishing 32nd. Steve Grisham in the Petty 44, finishing 33rd. Bobby Labonte in the 18, who actually had a motor issue. That's why he's a little back there, finishing the 34. Kevin Harvick, who's also on that list of drivers who are still racing. I need to go through this list a little better next time. He still races in today. He finished in the 29 car, 35th position. Dale Earnhardt Jr. in the number 8, finishing 36. Ricky Craven, who has one of the best race finishes of all time at Darlington with Kurt Busch, finishing 37th in the 32 car. Jeremy Mayfield in the number 19, finishing 38th. Elliot Sadler in the 21 for the Wood Brothers, finishing 39th. Hunt Strickland. I keep, every time they said this name, and I have to say, they said that name during the broadcast, I kept thinking of Buck Strickland from King of the Hill. In the number 23 car, finishing 40th, Stacey Compton, finishing in the 41st position in the 41 car. Shauna Robinson in the 49, finishing 42nd. And Ken Schrader, finishing last in the 43rd in the 36 car. He had an engine let go 3 laps into the race. By the way, I was not making that up when I said that. If you are a King of the Hill fan, you know who Buck Strickland is. I kept hearing Buck Strickland every time they talked about the 23 car.
And Hunt Strickland is just such an interesting character in NASCAR. He came on the scene somewhere around the late 80s, and I heard his name when I was growing up because obviously I remember him from his fantastic finish in the number 90 car. No, excuse me, the number 09 car for. James Finch of the 2002 500 and just the various races he ran, but I didn't know that he'd been racing that long, and he'd had a lot of success on the super speedway races, drove for some pretty notable drivers throughout the 80s and 90s, but just could never really find a lot of steady success, never could get hooked up with a big team and really could get gelling with a good crew chief. So he kind of fell by the wayside as we got to the early 2000s, and this was one of the last few seasons we would see him on a Cup Series entry list. So kind of a really disappointing, but like you, it was always humorous to hear Hut Strickland growing up. I'm like, why would you name your kid Hut? They told the story of how he got the name on one of the Daytona broadcasts, but I can't remember. And I also found out what his actual name was, and I was like, wait, that's what his actual name is? But I'm going to Google that right now because now I'm curious.
I got it right now. It's Wadlin Lane Hunt Strickland Jr.
It's Hut, not Hunt.
So,
like a Pizza Hut.
Real quick. Pizza Hut. Now I'm hungry.
Oh, don't talk about Pizza Hut. They're not delivering in Myrtle Beach anymore. Oh, gosh.
Oh, no.
No, it's a tragedy. Go ahead.
Looking at because I'm looking at his Wikipedia right now, I'm looking at some of the teams he raced for. He raced for Rick Hendrick in the 51 car. In the 1990, he raced for Bobby Allison Motorsports from 1990 to 1992. He just ran Junior Johnson Associates, Travis. I mean, there's so many interesting race teams he raced for, and it's a really interesting to just look at that.
Also, if you're like me, you most notably remember Hut Strickland as being the driver of the legendary number 8 Circuit City car. You want to talk about the most 90s badass-looking paint scheme. It was the Circuit City
right
car with
now.
That red and that black lightning bolt. God, that was so iconic to me growing up. Yeah, that was definitely what I always will associate Hut Strickland with, was being the driver of the badass Circuit City car.
That car is good-looking, especially with the number 8 on it. So, going back to the race, it was action-packed because there was just so many – ooh, I got the burps now. Golly, so many interesting drivers up there. Kurt Busch, who that was his second year running Ryan Newman, Dale Jarrett, Michael Waltrip, Stacey Compton, Jimmy Johnson, Dave Blaney all led at least one lap. Even Bill Elliott, awesome Bill from Dawsonville, led three laps towards the end of the race. David Blaney led quite a few laps himself. I mean, it's just interesting to look at this and see how many lead changes actually happen. I'm counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20 lead changes for that race. We don't even see like 6 lead changes sometimes in races these days, but to see 20 at Auto Club for back then, that's just nuts and wild to me.
And also the thing that really stands out to me looking through this finishing order, looking at the names, not just the drivers that have come and gone, but the teams that have come and gone. You mentioned it earlier, Jack Roush Racing back then, no Fenway partnership, that deal that wasn't struck until 2007. But you look at some of these teams. I'm looking at Yates Racing, one of the most prevalent teams of the late 80s all the way through the early 2000s. Robert Yates Racing was one of the most top, well-respected, most recognized four teams that just kind of fell by the wayside. And if you watch any given Sunday, the remnants of what used to be that team kind of essentially became, you know, the foundation that was laid for the team that's competing currently on the circuit, Front Row Motorsports. Front Row has, you know, the famous 34-38 combo that has been winning underdog races left and right for all the small teams out there. So just kind of an interesting little connection there. Looking a little further down the list, you see Chip Ganassi Racing and Dale Earnhardt Incorporated. At one point, Chip Ganassi had four teams. Dale Earnhardt Incorporated had three, and then four teams as well. And then they eventually merged in 2009, forming Earnhardt Ganassi Racing before Teresa Earnhardt and the Earnhardt name eventually pulled out of NASCAR altogether just to be running the operation as a we won't even go there. But but so the last remnants of Dale Earnhardt Incorporated, the racing team, is the number one currently used by Chip Ganassi Racing by Kurt Busch. Because when Earnhardt Ganassi Racing started in 2009 as that partnership, that was the one number that carried over from the remnants of DEI to the new Earnhardt Ganassi setup. And then eventually when Teresa pulled out, Chip just kept use of the number one, and that is the only connection left there. Looking down even further, while this one really, really pains me, while Richard Petty still competes as a team owner, Richard Petty Motorsports isn't the original Petty team. It's actually the remnants of the old Ray Evernham team, which you see that also up there in the top five. Bill Elliott finished fourth in the number nine, Ray Evernham Dodge. But Ray Evernham became a victim of the economy crashing in late 08. At that point, he had four potent Dodges, but eventually he had to strike a merger with Richard Petty, who was also hit hard by the economy and all the sponsorship dollars kind of drying up in late 2007, early 2008. And so those two teams struck a merger, forming Richard Petty Motorsports, the team that now competes today with Bubba Wallace. And that team has just really fallen on hard times. But seeing this entry list, seeing this finishing order and the name Petty Enterprises, and knowing that legendary level cross shop is no longer in operation, it's now a museum and a testament to the Petty legacy. But it just breaks my heart knowing that storied team that pretty much was built the bedrock of NASCAR racing as it is today has kind of fallen by the wayside. It makes you feel sad, you know. And also teams like Larry McClure and the famous number four team, they also kind of went by the wayside right around the recession of 08. Junie Donlevy's team, the number 90, Donlevy passed away a few years ago, and it was really sad knowing that the Virginia that gave so much to the sport was no longer there to brighten your day with his just infectious smile. You know, just names upon names that are just scattered, littered throughout this finishing order, just pioneers that built the sport that are no longer either associated with sport or their teams have kind of folded up and gone away. It makes you nostalgic, makes you sad, but, you know, that's just kind of the unfortunate business aspect of the sport that we all know and love.
And that's a crazy thing to look at, you know, the teams that have left, merged, or even just like, I guess just sub, you know, just kind of went away. It's so, because even Roger Penske is still racing to this day. And at one point he was one of those teams that was on the brink of shutting down. You have Richard Childress, who was running three and four cars, who's now on two cars. Even in this race, he had three cars. I'm actually pulling up the race schedule right now to get the full rundown of everything. But it's just so it's so interesting to see this and to see everything that has happened with all of these teams, and not just the teams, but also these drivers, because there's a lot of different drivers who are, you know, just, I guess the best way to put it, that there are legendary drivers on here, such as Michael Waltrip, who's won 2 Daytona 500s, the same with Dale Earnhardt Jr. You have Jeff Gordon, a 4-time series champion, Tony Stewart, a 3-time series champion, now his own team owner. But then you have drivers like Casey Atwood, who kind of bled away, or Mike Skinner, who, you know, has done just some TV stuff for the show for Amazon. It's
Top
what Top Gear used to be. It's not that though. Something car, but whatever. But then it's weird to go. It's really weird to run down this list. Look at the teams, look at the drivers, and also look at some of the sponsors. Miller Lite, technically still a sponsor. Not by much, but still a sponsor. Lowe's, no longer a sponsor, was with Jimmy Johnson for 16 seasons. 16, right? Yeah, 16 seasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you see stuff that's not even like singular wireless with Spider-Man, evidently, for Robbie Gordon for that race. Coors Original, UPS, who no longer sponsors, Caterpillar, DeWalt Tools, actually still sponsors, Kellogg, Pennzoil. You know, it's weird to run. It's cool to run down this, but it's weird at the very same time to see what all, you know, all these teams and all these races and all that. It's just like, wow.
And, you know, kind of circling back to the whole reason we had fans watch this race in particular and what it means to the 2020 season, Jimmy Johnson, this was his first NASCAR win. Like you remarked, it was in his 13th start. And, you know, in those first 13 starts, he'd shown some promise, but not near the promise that of the career that would transpire and kind of, you know, evolve from this first win. He would go on to score 2 more wins in his 2002 rookie campaign and finish an impressive 5th in points. He'd back that up next year in 2003 by winning another three races and finishing 2nd in points. He would go back to in 2004, win 8 races, finish 2nd in points. In 2005, he would go through 4 races, 5th in points, before finally winning 5 races in 2006 en route to his first of 5 consecutive championships. And all of that got started on a sunny California afternoon. And just the elation in the team victory lane, and also kind of something that kind of gets looked over, not really talked a whole lot about Jimmy Johnson's career, is not that Jeff Gordon was his mentor during those times. He was also a car owner. Hendrick Motorsports made Jeff a very integral part of his future planning and his future, you know, options of who he wants running the operation when Rick Hendrick himself can no longer be the face of Hendrick Motorsports. And Jeff has been a huge, huge part of that process and that retirement planning for Mr. H. And this all got started way back in 2002 when Jeff Gordon told Rick, "Hey, we have to take a chance on this driver. You will not regret it. Jimmy is the real deal." And he showed it in that rookie campaign. He took that first win, got 2 more, finished 5th. He was in contention late in 2002 for that first championship. He could have been a rookie champion. He had a few bad races late in the season that kind of derailed those hopes at Talladega, Atlanta, and Charlotte mainly, where he finished 37th. 22nd and 37th, respectively, at those 3 races. Had it not been for those very subpar finishes, he may have been even 2nd or may have been the champion that year. We never will know. But just kind of, you know, putting our 2020, you know, retrospective lenses on, just our hindsight, thinking back on the career, 83 wins, 7 championships, 5 in a row. He's got 2 Daytona 500 champion titles to his name. He's won the Southern 500. He's won the Brickyard 400. He's won the Coke 600. He's won the All-Star event. He's literally won everything there is. And at the end of the season, he's going to put it all to a close and go on to the next racing venture in his life. If you're looking at his rig from Sunday and kind of some of his social media, it seems that open wheel is his destination. And maybe giving Formula One, maybe giving IndyCar a try. And we have to just take, you know, take stock of what we've seen over the course of these 19 seasons, 18 years. We've got to see Jimmy Johnson and the 48 team, just the history being made in front of our eyes to the likes, the heights of Richard Petty, Dale Earnhardt, two Goliaths in our sport. People, when Earnhardt won his seventh championship in 94, never thought we would see that feat matched again. We never thought, with as competitive as NASCAR has become, as close quarters, as tight, as things come down to the millisecond, the fraction of an inch, we never thought we would see that level of success, that paramounted level of success again. But then in comes Jimmy Johnson, completely turns the sport over on its ear, and has just been breaking records ever since. And as we look forward to hopefully getting the 2020 season, you know, restarted and getting Jimmy Johnson's final, you know, season back on track, you've got to really appreciate how it all kind of came from this 2002 race in California, where it really set the stage for the NASCAR world to know that, hey, Jimmy Johnson is not just some no-name from the Busch Series anymore. He is a Cup Series winner. He is a proven talent, quite arguably at that time. Many rightfully picked him as being the next Jeff Gordon, the next driver that would push the sport even further, you know, and really motivate everyone to up their game to even higher lengths than they ever thought before. And the sport has kind of grown around Johnson and around that success. We've constantly seen tweaks to the schedule, you know, tweaks to the cars, tweaks to the chase, tweaks to the playoff formats, to the points, all in an effort to stop Jimmy Johnson from doing what he does best, and that's delivering an absolute butt-kicking. And that race was no different. He led a bulk of the laps, was out front, you know, dicing and mixing it up with Kurt Busch, was constantly a threat all afternoon, and that kind of performance is what we've kind of come to expect from the seven-time champion, and that is what we've come to know as the level of expertise and excellence that is the Jimmy Johnson way.
For sure, and just want to put this in perspective for a lot of people. Jimmy Johnson is one of those drivers who he didn't do much before in NASCAR, I should say, for racing. He only did a handful of starts in the 98 season. The 99, he did a few more handful of starts, and then did two full seasons in Xfinity. And then 2002 is when he took off and has stayed in the Cup Series since then. He has done handful of races in the Xfinity Series for Hendrick Motorsports, Junior Motorsports, and even did one Truck Series race for Randy Moss Racing in the 81 back in 2008. But that's it. I mean, his resume, you don't look at his Xfinity, you know, he only has one win. It's in Chicago. You don't look at that. You look at his Cup stuff, you know, seven championships, got tons of wins. He has two Daytona 500 championships, and it really, and I do have to say this, a really clean record. He has 83 wins, 366 top 10, 36 poles. It's an astonishing thing, and it started with that Sunday's race in California, his home track essentially, his home oval track, I should say, because he's from California, but he also runs Sonoma, which isn't too far from him either. One thing that I feel is interesting is I was looking at the actual team names, and I know we already passed that, but I look at these and I'm just like, I look at them and I'm like, wow, it's weird to see, you know, Fenway Racing not there, Bill Davis Racing not there, you know, Haas Charter Motorsports, like, yes, Stuart Haas is still, a Haas Automation.
It's a different Haas.
In the racing.
Yeah, the Haas of Haas Carter is Carl Haas. It's not Gene. Because I thought that, too,
when
I looked that up, and it went down a rabbit hole kind of seeing how different teams were bought out and changed over the years from the course of the 90s. And I was like, wait, Haas? That isn't Gene Haas, is it? But no, it's this guy named Carl Haas, not even related to the CNC magnet.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
and again, that's just like, I look at these teams and I look at the drivers associated with them, because that's what you think about. You think about those drivers with those chiefs. You think of Ricky Craven in the 32. You think Dale Earnhardt Jr. in the 8. That's the good thing. He went to the 88, so people who got the 8 tattoos didn't have to do much changing. But then you have, like, Jimmy Spencer in the 41, Jerry Nadeau. It's so weird not to see a lot of these numbers and teams in there anymore. I mean, we still have the Wood Brothers Racing, who had Elliott Sadler racing for them. We had Ken Schrader, who still races, not in the Cup Series, or not in NASCAR per se, but still races in dirt stuff. I mean, heck, he'll probably be up in your neck of the woods, Brady, sometime this year racing if racing gets to go. I love
it. Yeah, he is at least a play to be right up around this area in early April, and I'm hoping to go out to see him on the dirt tracks if we can get these COVID bans lifted and we get back to racing, because I would love to see my childhood hero back in action on the dirt where he's doing what he does best, and that's winning.
You know, guys, I wanted to make a remark about the COVID thing since you mentioned that. It seems like, if you really think about it, way too many people have postponed things till right around the 1st of May. And it seems like a lot of people had an idea that that would be the time when we might be able to get started with our lives again. I mean, I don't know if you heard what the president said today, but he said he hopes to get the American economy back on track in the middle of April.
By Easter.
And, and what I can tell you is I've been in discussions, because I've got 5 Comic-Cons that I've had to put on hold, which was kind of inconvenient because that's my job and my life. But it seems like everybody's kind of on board with getting everything back together in the May-June timeframe, even though we're still experiencing a rise in the cases. So it seems like there's a certain consciousness, like the lemmings, you know, when it's time for them to go run, jump off a cliff. It seems like there's been a little bit of a consciousness that we might be in okay shape as we tend toward the end of April. And that's just something I noticed today as I heard so many people talking about everything. It's like, we kind of know it'll be all right by then. Now, it won't be perfect, but it'll be better. And, you know, and I'm hoping we can all head up to Martinsville. I mean, because I love Martinsville, Virginia. I mean, I love that place. It's a great place. So anyway, just wanted to mention that.
That
seems like there's a little. Do what? I've got some friends who are outstanding professional artists that live up there, and that's why I like the area. So it'll be cool if I can get to see them and maybe bring them out with us, Zach, and all that. So we'll have to start thinking about those, and I'll make sure not to slap a Comic-Con in the middle of Martinsville, okay?
Do not do that. But, you know, I do hope we go back soon, but I do love what we are doing as race fans in general, not just, you know, us here at the podcast, but overall there's people who are, like Brady, watching the older races, are enjoying these iRacing simulator races that we get to, you know, get live commentary from, you know, just like a regular race. It's something that we're hoping to go back to normal soon, and we're also hoping to have a blast when it goes back to normal, especially when we get those big cup cars running at places like Atlanta, at Martinsville, at Texas. Oh, I can't wait for Texas. That's always a great race, especially, and I can't wait because we still have that bounty on Kyle Busch. Some people have kind of forgotten about that, but there's over $100,000 on the line for someone to beat out Kyle Busch this year. Guys?
Okay, Dr. Jones here. Were we
saying turned into a robot? Hello?
You there?
I'm here. Are you?
I can hear Brady. He's very faint. Can you hear me?
I cannot. Oh, yeah. I can hear. Oh, there's Brady.
All right. Is Dr.
Right.
John?
That was interesting. All right then. So, overall, the auto club, what was it called again? The Napa Auto Club.
Napa Auto Parts 500.
At Auto Club, fantastic race, kicked off the legacy that we know of Jimmy Johnson. And one cool thing is that Rick Hendrick was there at that race. Rick wasn't going to a lot of races back then because of health issues. and that was one of the first few races that he was able to get to. So that was really cool. So coming up, we actually are going to do the Retro Rewind still, even though we will have the iRacing races going on. Which should we talk about first? Should we talk about the trucks or the Texas iRace, or talk about what race everyone needs to watch for next weekend?
We can get it set up for the Texas race.
All right. So
yeah, we got 10 minutes left.
The Texas race for the Pro Invitational for NASCAR. I'm trying to see if there is a name. I don't know if they have put it out there yet. I'm looking right now. Google. I feel like the entry list, there's no entry list yet for it. Let's see here. J-Ski, it doesn't have a name for it yet. We don't know the length race or anything. J-Ski, who is a popular NASCAR website, has nothing on it just yet. So we know there will be a race. We don't know when, or we don't have a specific time, I don't think, just yet. I take that back. It will be about 1 p.m. at Virtual Texas, which hopefully that means regular 1 p.m.
It's 1 p.m. Eastern, noon Central.
Yes. So that will be an interesting race to see. I can't wait to see what and it's going to be everywhere. So it's going to be on Fox Sports 1 and the Fox Sports app. So if you aren't able to watch it there, you can watch it on YouTube. It won't be live. It will be a afterthought, but it is going to be available for everyone and anyone on YouTube. That's actually where I watch a lot of races if I can't catch them because, well, work. But our Retro Rewind for the week is actually a fun race. It is the Fall Talladega race from 2009. I'm looking up Talladega. So what's interesting, and the big reason we chose this race was I don't want to say impact because that's a wrong word, I think, for it right now. It had a very big safety presence, we'll say it like that, for NASCAR. There was a very scary crash that involved Ryan Newman, kind of like here at the Daytona 500 this year, that implemented a new roll bar feature. There we go. That's what I was looking for.
Roll bar would end up becoming known as the Newman bar, which would become instrumental in saving his life with the scary crash at Daytona. And we're going to talk a lot about that in depth. And there's also going to be some differing things we're going to hear about during this broadcast. In reference to the yellow line rules and bump drafting after the yellow line controversy of the 2008 fall race at Talladega and then the spring race that year, the Aaron's 499, where Carl Edwards went up in the catch fence, NASCAR implemented some really strict rules and guidelines in reference to bump drafting and in reference to the yellow line rules. So we'll definitely have to talk about that at length when we get to a recap the 2009 Amp Energy 500. Especially because there were some very long-lasting impacts from that very strict no-bumping rule kind of thing that they were trying to institute for this fall 09 race. So we'll definitely have to talk about that. Jamie McMurray will be pretty instrumental. We'll have to talk about him a little bit about that. That is on our docket for next week.
It is the 2009 Amp Energy 500 at Talladega. It was not ran on November 1st, was it?
It was.
That's right. Wow. My mind had them backwards for some reason. I'm excited to rewatch that. It is available on YouTube. All you have to do is search 2009 Amp Energy 500. It will be one of the first ones on there. The whole race is on there, including even some of the post-race, which is something I want to talk about in these last few minutes. Brady, you watched the race. You watched it on YouTube, correct?
Correct.
How did you like that they still did a lot of the post. They kept a lot of the post-race interviews and stuff. And because now, whenever we watch NASCAR races, there's not a whole lot of post-race stuff. There's a little bit, and then it's like, okay, if you want more coverage, go to Fox Sports 1. All right, later. But there, back then, it was, you know, you actually got full-length interviews with multiple drivers and even some post-race stuff right then and there, not having to change channels or go to, you know, online because they didn't really have it back then. How do you like it as much as I do, getting able to see the old times where we got the full-length interview, we got to see what other drivers said and not have to go, oh, I have to go to Twitter, or I have to go to Facebook, or I have to go to this or that?
No, I definitely liked when NASCAR used to do that, especially when I was growing up out with my parents. There was a lot of us kids, we really didn't have cable because it was not really something that we could afford or was something necessary that we felt like was a commodity that was necessary for our family. So we didn't get to see any races that were broadcast on ESPN, Fox Sports, TNT back in the day, you know, or what have you. And so when I was a kid and I got to watch the occasional race on Fox or the race on NBC, I really appreciated that they would give me as many post-race interviews as they could possibly squeeze in. And they would give a full-blown winner's interview in the winner's circle. And because I would stay there pinned, glued for half hour, 45 minutes at a time, depending on when the race would wrap up, and watch all of that content, because that was all the content NASCAR-wise that I would get in a week at some point. So, you know, I think back on those moments, you know, nostalgically and fondly, but like, yeah, these were very important to me, and I'm glad that they, you know, keep that as part of those broadcasts when I go back and rewatch some of these old races that meant a lot to me as a kid. You know, I like that they still include that content, because it's really, you know, neat to see some of the pre-race features, some of the drivers, you know, how they've grown from what they were back in their early seasons to what they are now. And, you know, kind of seeing and picking up some of the journalistic nuances of how they were setting up the Fox broadcast back then. Because you think about it, 2002 was very early on in the Fox broadcasting career. They didn't start taking over races until 2001. So by that point, they had only had a half a season under their belt production-wise. So it was really fun to kind of see how not only how the production had grown in their first year, but how it's grown since then and how they've really kind of revolutionized motorsports journalism and motorsports broadcasts, you know, and set the precedent for many years to come. And it all started back with some of these earlier races in the early 2000s. So from that aspect, it's also really cool to watch these old broadcasts and just reminisce and just reflect on how we've come as an industry.
2001 was the first year we really had NASCAR on Fox airing the Daytona 500 from there. And I do love it. I do love, you know, because that is one thing you get to have and get to see is the emotion that these drivers have. You know, Jimmy Johnson at the celebration they had with seeing Rick Hendrick and Jeff Gordon come into the fray and get to talk to, you know, their driver, their new legend to be, and they didn't know at that point. I love it because I love seeing the emotion, especially seeing someone's first win, and we did get to see that this year so far in this regular season. I know we're gonna reference that a little bit, but Noah Gregson didn't get his first win in the Xfinity Series. You know, the celebration he had along with just the crazy, you know, post-race interview in Victory Lane that we actually got to see, and then they cut it. But I love that we get to see, you know, 5, 6, 7 different drivers interviewed. You get to hear, you know, I could have done this better, could have done that better, you know, or, you know, even getting a team owner an interview. You know, it's just so much fun, and the love for the sport is still there, especially with all of the heart, I guess, is the best way to put it back then.
Exactly.
Well, guys, it looks like we're about ready to head on to the hills and come back next week. But it's been great being here with you. And as we hunt down for the coronavirus and still have a great time here on the Charlotte Line. So, Brady, you got a 10-second goodbye?
Thanks for tuning in, everyone. We'll see you next week.
Zach, what have you got?
Let's see, Virtual Race of Texas, 1 p.m. next this Sunday, and the AMP Energy 500 from 2009, Watch it. We'll talk about it. There's no league still, so Todd, you're still winning. Electric Boogaloo to the zoo.
All right. And I'll say big Comic-Con announcement next week. Well, I'll have something for everybody that will be meaningful for all of us. So thanks a lot from the Charlotte Line, from Studio G, from Studio Myrtle Beach, and from the cold of Des Moines, Iowa. This is the Charlotte Line. Take care. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.